Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. My name's Sarah McDilling and I'm here today with comedian, poet and journalist Ben Popchi.
Hello Sarah, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. I'm so happy to be here. It's a thrill.
It's a thrill to have you here.
I feel like a celebrity, which is what I want to be.
That's how we always want our authors to feel. You have written an amazing book. Can you tell us about this book, please?
Yes, the book is called Error Australis. That's a pun. It's called Error Australis. It is a history of Australia from pre-Captain Cook times right up to quite recently, right up to the Turnbull Prime Ministership, covering the scope of Australian history. Written somewhat... I've recapped it. I mean, I've spent a lot of time recapping reality TV shows, which have been, you know, rather well received, recapping My Kitchen Rules and MasterChef and so on. And so I thought, I have recapped our country from start to finish in that same fashion. So one might say it's a humorous book, a comedy book. One might say that it is more interesting than other history books, funnier, more enjoyable. Whether it is more factual than other history books, it's hard to say. But there are facts in there for those lovers of facts.
Including facts. A history book including facts.
And basically, it's the story of Australia recapped in a way so as to make reading history fun. Does that sounds... No, that sounds terrible. It's not making history fun the way that teachers, like, you know, make children write raps about Shakespeare. It's history with jokes. Yeah. It's history with jokes. That's what it is.
Well, and history is so often viewed as such a dry subject.
Yes, particularly Australian history. Because Australian history, when you're at school, I mean, I think we all learnt a bit of Australian history at school.
I don't think I learnt very much. This is what I was...
We don't learn that much. And what we do learn is it glosses over a lot of stuff. And the impression you always get as a kid growing up in Australia is that Australia has the boring history and that fun, interesting history happened in America and Europe and the Middle East and all these places. And so you learn about, you know, English history, French history, Roman history, American history, and it's like, this is fantastic because there's a lot of big wars and there's a lot of revolutions and there's a lot of murders and it's just soaked in blood from start to finish. And then you get to Australian history and you're like, oh yeah, it's mostly just guys mapping rivers. And you get to, you know, Federation, and it's like, there's not even like a fight over Federation. Some old men with beards just got together in a room. And so that's the impression you get. And it's not... But I don't think the history of any country is actually boring. Every country on Earth, I think, has a really fascinating and weird and frequently stupid history. And Australia is no exception. And I think... if you look at history from the perspective of just wanting to make jokes about it, because that's what I did when I started writing it. I wasn't like, oh, I want to make history fun for everyone. I was like, I just want to write a really funny book and let's make it about history, because I know a bit about history and there's a lot of stuff to make fun of, obviously, because a lot of stuff happens in 200, 300 years. So, but the more you... get into it, the more I got into it, started writing, and I'm writing these jokes, and the more I was actually learning little bits that I hadn't actually known before, the more you realise that I think history is always going to be more interesting when you don't treat it all that seriously. I think people are almost put off Australian history because of the reverence we have for the things we do know. We're sort of encouraged to see our history, people from history, figures from history are noble and they're like statues.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if you, this is a bit off topic, but I don't know if you've ever seen it. There's like a little series of photographs that it went around the internet a while ago, and it's a couple from like maybe late 1800s, turn of the 20th century type thing, and they pose, there's three or four photos, they're posing all seriously as people did in those days.
Yeah.
And then the next photo shows the woman sneezing. And then the next photo shows them like laughing about the fact that they messed up the photo. And that to me was just one of those moments where you're like, oh, people in the past are just normal people.
Exactly. They actually did laugh. They didn't smile in photos because photos took 2 hours to take and your mouth would start hurting. But it's, you look back and you look at the people of history, and history, that's all it is. It's just a story of people doing stuff. And you realise this idea we have that today we live in an age where public figures and politicians and famous people are all idiots and we all make fun of them. But that in the past, everything was much more serious and everyone was highly intelligent and thoughtful and working. You get the idea that people in history thought of themselves as people in history and always had them always had their minds on, how will this look in the history book? And they did. You look at the people and you realise everyone back then was just as big an idiot as they are now.
They're just living their lives.
You look at the people. I mean, God, the explorer, it's in the book. The famous explorers, Hume and Hovell, were morons. Hovell, anyway. Hume wasn't so bad. But they had a big fight and they decided that they would separate. They had a set trial separation as explorers. But they did it.
Perhaps?
Yeah, but they did it I Love Lucy style. They split all their stuff up down to the point where they had a frying pan and they broke the frying pan into the pan and the handle, and Hume took the pan and Hovell took the handle. And it's like, what? And these are the people we're supposed to think, yeah, they built our nation. And then when they got back together, they ended up in completely the wrong spot. They went back. They were going to Western Port Bay. They went back to the city and said, oh, we found Western Port Bay. It's a really great place for farming. And then when the farmers went down to Western Port Bay, they found out that it was rubbish because Hume and Hovell hadn't even been... They'd gone in the wrong direction and end up in the wrong spot. And that's the sort of thing that happens in history.
It is starting to sound like reality TV, though.
It is, and that's why it's so good, because I write the recaps of reality TV, and it's... And all I am doing is making fun of people making fools of themselves. And that's what I did in the book.
Well, I mean, I love TV recaps. In many cases, I end up loving the recaps more than I like the actual show.
Well, that's the aim.
Yeah. but the idea of reading a history book that is written along the line of a reality recap, I just think that's a great idea. And I'm not lucky enough to have read the book yet. I have to wait until it comes out. However, I did read the introduction, and I really loved it. And I also think that the blurb is really amazing and would give people an excellent idea of what this book is about. Would you, because I also know that you're a performance poet, is that correct?
That's true.
Would you use your mad vocal performance poet skills to read out the blurb for our podcast listeners?
Absolutely. Okay. This is the blurb, and it'll probably be a better description than what I just did, because I had more time to think about
it.
Yeah, okay, so this appears on the back of the book. We're engrossed with reality TV these days, yet we so often neglect the greatest reality of all, the reality of our nation and how it came to be. In Era Australis, TV columnist, comedian and history buff Ben Pobje, oh, I hate saying my name, Ben Pobje recaps the history of Australia from its humble beginnings as a small patch of rapidly cooling rock to its modern day status as one of the major powers of the sub-Asian super-Antarctic next to Africa region. As thrilling as it is to see Delta Goodrum's chair turn around, there's an argument that World War II was even more exciting. And like any good recapper, Pobje provides an immediate, visceral sense of what it was like to be there in the moment at our nation's defining events. It is only by looking at where we have been that we can understand who we are, what we stand for, and why nothing seems to work. Era Australis is a scholarly and hilarious account of a young nation that has spent many years seeking its place in the world and almost as many years not liking what it has found. So that's, oh, that sounds so boastful when I read it out.
As I was listening to it, I'm like, oh, I've made you call your own book hilarious.
Yeah. But I'm like... It is. I mean, obviously it is.
Obviously it is. I also made you talk about yourself in the third person, so as I apologise for that.
As an Australian, I don't want to seem up myself. That's a good decision. That, you know, it's a typically Australian book. We don't want to seem up ourselves, so I've written a book about how hilariously rubbish everything is. No, it's not. It's... It really is a recap in that you look at history and you can make a joke about anything. And so that's really what it is. It's making fun. It's like watching the movie of Australia and you've got someone next to you who you really want to impress. And so you just keep making snarky comments throughout. And that's, so I've written a book that hopefully is a bit like that. Like you have a really funny friend watching a movie next to you and the movie is very serious, but your friend is taking the piss at every turn.
Which is the best way to watch a film, actually.
It's pretty good.
I wanted to, swinging back to your reality TV recaps and this approach to writing a history novel, what do you think it is, about reality TV that it just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger? Because considering the cost of making your average reality TV show, you would think it would be the sort of thing that would have been more popular and then we would have grown out of it.
Well,
it's the opposite way.
You do have to remember for a start that with reality TV you do save money on the writing because there isn't any. That's a saving. But yeah, I mean, the big ones like MasterChef are very expensive, so they have to get a good return. You know what? I think reality TV survives because, first of all, because it's sort of mutated and changed so that the Big Brother style reality TV, that sort of very intense, let's just put people in a house and watch them go mad thing, is not so much the style.
Well, there's Geordie Shore still.
Is that still on?
Yeah.
Oh, but that's one of those scripted reality things. Isn't that like The Hills?
Yeah.
It's one of those things where it's like, basically, we're just making a soap opera. It just so happens we've got people who have no training in acting. So that sort of
thing.
But
you're right, most of them have.
But it's a trend. I mean, in Australia, there's obviously in bigger countries, there's more room for niche things to go. That's why you look at America and there's 100 different cooking shows, because 1% of the population in America is still a huge number.
Yeah.
And it can sustain a show. Whereas 1%, if you're not very broad, appealing to a very broad section of Australia, you can't be justified as a show. But like My Kitchen Rules is something that probably wouldn't have worked like 15 years ago when reality TV really exploded, because it is so based on bitchiness and nastiness.
We've got bitchier and nastier.
I think it goes well. I mean, there was things like Survivor, where there's obviously a lot of nastiness, but it really is about the competition and seeing who's smarter and who can maneuver themselves. And My Kitchen Rules, as much as the contestants on that show always talk about strategy, there is no strategy. You can't have a strategy in My Kitchen Rules except to cook well, and hardly any of them know how to do that. So in My Kitchen Rules, it's not really about watching people be strategic. It is just purely and simply about dividing the contestants into here's the ones we like and here's the ones we hate, and we're going to cheer for them and boo for them. And it's like a pantomime in that sense. It's very much heroes and villains.
Yeah.
And MasterChef, which is still hanging on, it's still doing fairly well, but My Kitchen Rules is doing much better now. When MasterChef came out, the trend was very much the feel-good stuff. You know, inspiration and people fulfilling their dreams.
Yeah.
And that's less important now, which is why The Block was very popular at first because of that aspect, and now The Block and House Rules and other renovation shows put a lot more emphasis on, here's a couple, we've put them in a very high-stress situation, let's watch their marriage disintegrate our eyes. Because that's what you have. If you see promos for MKR or The Block, what they're always playing up is the fights and the insults and the things going disastrously wrong.
Yeah.
As much as they can play that sort of inspirational, swelling music when something goes right on the show, they know that we're tuning in to see things go wrong. And so that's the modern trend. But also, it's very varied, reality TV. I mean, reality isn't even a genre. It's four or five different genres.
Yeah.
There is the competitive reality TV, and there's the fly on the wall reality TV, and then there's dating shows, which are their own weird thing that don't follow any kind of logic that the other shows do.
And then there's like fictional drama shows about reality TV shows, like Unreal.
Which I'm surprised it took so long for that to be made, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
That should have been, although there were other things that came along earlier, I suppose. But yeah, Unreal is like the biggest, the most intensive attempt to really send it up,
yeah.
I think, in a really high production value kind of way.
I think it's when I was watching that show, like watching a show about reality TV, that I was like, okay, reality TV is here to stay. Do you anticipate like future generations, like perhaps this dies down, maybe we don't watch TV anymore, like far in the future they'll look back on this trend of reality TV as like some incredibly insane thing that people did?
No, like, I can't say. Yeah. There could be a time when, yes, we don't watch TV anymore because TV will be, broadcast TV will be a strange, baffling thing to people. Like, they imagine, say, you sat down and, like, you just waited for it to come on at the same time every week. That's weird.
Well, that already seems
That's already weird to a lot of people. But that is actually kind of why reality TV keeps booming, because a reality show is one of the few things that you can convince people to sort of gather at the same time, weekly, and it's less piratable. And because of, you know, social media, you feel left out if you watch it a week after it's aired. Whereas other things, you can save up, and
it is like disposable TV. You've got to watch it when it's happening.
Yeah, you watch it when it's happening.
But like, and then you forget about it.
But like, if Netflix, you know, if MasterChef will put out like a Netflix show with every episode just dumped online at once, you wouldn't like it.
I don't
that
think
way.
You could binge watch
you
reality TV.
You can't binge crazy. Watch reality TV. It's too weird. It wouldn't work. But the basic concept of reality, which is not obviously it's not connected to reality very closely, but it is people who are not trained entertainers entertaining us and frantically trying to deal with an alien situation. I think that is quite universal and quite eternal, and so in one form or another it'll keep on going.
Yeah.
It's not so much, oh, it popped up and it was a fad. It's almost like it's surprising it took that long to become popular. Like there were sort of proto-reality things even back in the 70s.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say before, that I'm surprised that it is only now, like in recent, like the last 10 years or so, that it's really taken off, because it's a cheaper show to make. And you would have thought that it would become super, super popular in like the early days of TV and then drop off. But it's gone the other way.
Yeah. And, but I think what you have to realise is the average reality show, the most popular reality shows today are really the descendants of game shows more than anything. So I think that is what caused it to explode in this century to become a massive, massive industry, is that the element of competition and the element of the reality element was brought together.
Yeah.
So someone saw like the old Sylvania Waters or Cops.
Oh yeah.
I thought, okay, so just ordinary people going about their business but then they put it together with, you know,
cooking
or you know, The Price is Right, or It's a Knockout, and thought, well, hang on, so what if we got, okay, it's ordinary people, but we actually pit them against each other, and then we have it. I mean, Survivor is just a very expensive, large-scale game show.
Yeah.
And so is MasterChef, and so is My Kitchen Rules, and so is The Bachelor. I mean, The Bachelor is just Perfect Match, but with a, you know, big budget and this element of psychological torture inserted into it.
Did you, for the genesis of Era Australis, did you always know that you wanted to write this book, or did it sort of come out of doing your TV recap?
No, the desire to write a comedic book about history predates even watching reality TV, let alone writing about it, because I was at university a very long time ago, and I was studying Australian history, and I was sitting in Australian history lectures, and I was very, very bored. And that's not necessary. I was a reckless, irresponsible. I was an irresponsible person. It's not the lecturer's fault necessarily, although they could have spiced things up a bit. But so I had my notebook. Instead of taking actual notes, I was taking whatever the lecture said and writing little jokes, little riffs about it. I was basically, you know, the 1998 version of live tweeting. It was like live tweeting. I was writing little
brief asides
and snarky comments and absurdist stuff, like, you know, about you know, settlers having sex with kangaroos or whatever. Just little bits and pieces that would hopefully amuse my friend sitting next to me. So I'd sort of write a little joke and push the notebook over, and they'd go, and it was a way of getting through the lecture without absorbing much information and not preparing us at all for exams. So I was doing that, and I thought even back then it'd be cool to, you know, put together
a book like
to actually take this seriously and write something really funny about Australian history. But at that stage, I was sort of like, yes, that would be good, but I don't know how to write a book, and I don't know. I couldn't even imagine trying to enter the world. I had thoughts then that if I was to write a book, I was going to write a novel and become a novelist.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing. But as time went on, I got more interested in the sort of, what would you call it, humorous nonfiction? Like, yeah. Humor, the books you find in the humor section of a bookshop that are funny stuff. And other countries had their humorous history books. Like the original one really is 1066 and all that, which is a very, very funny history of Britain written in like the 1930s or long time ago. It's very, very funny, and that's like the starting point. And one of my favourite writers, Dave Barry, wrote a book of about American history in his style. And so eventually I got to the point of thinking I'd like to write a book about Australian history in my style. And it wasn't so much thinking, oh, I write reality TV recaps, let's write a book of these recaps, what it'll be about. It was more, I want to write a book about Australian history and make it funny. And I thought, well, what is my voice, to put it in pretentious author speak? What is my voice? What is my style? How will I make it funny? And I thought, well, I will write it like I write these recaps, this very, you know, this stream of consciousness thing. Because all it is talking about people doing things. It's a reality recap is me just watching a story unfold on TV and making fun of it. And you can do that with history. And that's And it, so yeah, it came out of that. The idea for a funny book about history
came earlier.
years and years ago. And then, but, you know, it's only recently that I sort of synthesized that and realized the way to do it, the way into it, if you know what I mean.
And you've been honing your recapping skills.
Well, I have. And I think the important thing about, you know, figuring out that way to do it, that method, is I therefore avoided the pitfall of looking at other funny books about history and trying to copy them in any way, which would be awful to try and adopt some other writer's voice and try and push it and think, oh, here's a good book, I'd like to write a book like that, and then writing a book like that.
Well, that goes across, I mean, that goes across all genres, but it's particularly true of comedy, that comedy is such a personal thing.
Yes.
It comes so much from how a person talks and sees the world.
Yes, it does. Yeah, and if you come up with a joke that has sprung not from your own desire to come up with something funny, but has sprung from your desire to mimic something funny someone else, it will clunk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you, having said that, what are your favourite comedians that you feel maybe did inspire you along the way, like maybe as a kid and stuff?
Monty Python was very big for me. And a lot of British comedy, you know, the history of British comedy. So Monty Python and Spike Milligan and The Young Ones and Blackadder and Fry and Laurie was very big for me. And then a bit later in Australia, Sean McAuliffe.
Who has given your book a good rap.
Yeah, and it's like it's like this surreal kind of, oh yeah, so 18-year-old me is just screaming with excitement because it's a book I've written and Sean McAuliffe has read it and given me a quote to put inside the cover. Well, it's absolutely incredible. Like, just the fact that I've reached a point where I've spoken to Sean McAuliffe actually is blowing my mind.
Sometimes just have to take a moment so that you can freak out.
It does. It's, you know, and it's an amazing feeling to have not just spoken to him as like a fan, which I am, but to have a sort of feeling like I can, you know, I've got this book and I'm writing stuff and I am a colleague, even though he's at the very top of his profession and I.
But you have written something that has amused and entertained him.
I'm closer to him than I ever thought I would be. but yeah, sorry. This isn't what I was talking about.
As soon as
McAuliffe comes up, I can't stop talking about McAuliffe. Yeah, so he was a big influence. And I mentioned Dave Barry, and Dave Barry was a massive influence on my stuff as a writer, as a purveyor of the written word.
Mm.
So columns and this book itself and things that are meant to be written and the art of making people laugh out loud with something just on a page. Because there are actually a lot of very funny writers who you read it and you think that's very funny, but it's actually a lot harder to make someone laugh from something they've just read.
I wanted to ask you if you make yourself laugh when you write, because...
Not when I write. No. But sometimes when I go back and read later, when I'm actually writing it, I'm not thinking... Like, obviously, I'm thinking, yes, this is funny. But I'm not giggling all the way through. Maybe I'm too close to it. But sometimes I will, for whatever reason, go back and read something I have written a while back, and I almost surprise myself because I do laugh, and I'm like, oh yeah, I did pretty well there. That was good.
I laughed my way through the introduction, which is all I've gotten to read.
That's a good sign.
But yeah,
it's a good start, anyway, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. So I should mention Douglas Adams.
Oh, of course.
And Terry Pratchett, in terms of authors. Were big influences.
It's that great mix of just like amazing use of language, like almost joyful sarcasm and like absurdity.
Yeah.
In nearly everyone you've mentioned that you also have yourself in your writing.
Yeah. And that brings to mind another one, P.G. Wodehouse,
oh.
who I just adore. My father introduced me to him when I was quite young, and I just love him. And the word joyous that you used is so perfect, because it's the beauty of words and the pure beauty of using words to make someone laugh.
Yeah.
And that feeling of there isn't a, it, you can do anything. I mean, you know, we were talking about Australian history before and how, you know, it's an interesting, you know, it's a worthy cause to use humour to interest people in history, to teach people about history. And that's all true. But at its base, I think, if you get absolutely nothing out of what I write except laughter, that's totally enough. Like, that's a massive thing, and it's a wonderful thing. And like P.G. Wodehouse, his absolute love of the words he's using shines through. And you can just see, you can feel this satisfaction with verbiage.
Yeah, 100%. Sometimes if I'm just feeling a little bit depressed, I will pick up a P.G. Wodehouse book just to cheer myself up.
And it's like, I think Stephen Fry described it as, you know, the lesson of Wodehouse is just, as I said, it is enough. Being funny is enough.
Yeah, and well, with P.G. Wodehouse, often he was writing very simple stories, and it was all in the way that it was told, and the humour that was used, the language that was used.
And there are no lessons to be learned in those books at all. He's not... There's a very mild strain of satire, but we in the 20th century, it's whatever he's satirising is probably unrecognisable to us anyway.
Yeah, you get the feeling of it, but you don't and, know the stereotype.
And the characters are so broad. There's no psychological interrogation of them of any kind. It's just purely the language, the descriptions, the dialogue. It's just beautiful, and it just makes you laugh for no other reason than that it's funny. It's not funny because it's true, and it's not funny because it's taking down anyone. It's just wonderful. Funny. It's but just funny, it's and it's funny. Also poetic in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he's the way he's weaving words around.
Well, I mean, while it's very different because you're talking about history, there is in that P.G. Wodehouse and many of the other people you've mentioned, comedy in the unexpected. Like, who would have thought with Douglas Adams that science fiction could be so funny?
Yeah.
And who would have thought that, like, a little, you know, that the English tongue would be so funny? And so you've essentially done the same thing. You've focused on Australian history and found the humour in it.
Well, I definitely think that part of the reason I was so eager to take it on as a subject is because it is seen, the popular opinion is that Australian history is one of the most boring subjects around. And even if you don't find it boring, even if you are someone who is really into history, in Australia anyway, you are probably thinking it's interesting in a very serious and po-faced way. And you're thinking of it in terms of, you know, the stuff that gets thrown around at Anzac Day every year about everything is about respect and reverence. And I thought it's a great subject for comedy because everyone either treats it with respect and reverence or is completely bored by it. And so it's almost like, it makes it all the more enjoyable to rip into it with jokes and just, you know, it's at times you feel like you've come across an amazingly elaborate sandcastle on the beach and you just take joy in just poking holes in it and bit by bit knocking bits off and laughing.
Is there like a favourite chapter or a favourite individual in Australian history that you enjoyed writing about the most?
It's really hard to be. I really like Ben Hall, the bushranger, because he has got a bad rap from history because we're obsessed with Ned Kelly. And Ben Hall has a story that should have had 100 movies made about it. He is this tragic, romantic hero who didn't even kill him. He was like the honourable bushranger. Not too honourable because he was still a criminal, but he was an honourable bushranger. He was driven to bushranging by police oppression and also by his wife dumping him. Aww. And it's such a beautiful cinematic story, and I feel sorry for Ben Hall as a historical figure, because the only reason Ned Kelly, let's be honest, the only reason Ned Kelly is the most famous bushranger is because he put on a helmet. And it looks amazing in pictures to see this weird robot man walking through the bush with his guns. Ben Hall is at least as interesting as Ned Kelly, and probably a better story than Ned Kelly's. But Kelly has the funny hat. And so I really love Ned Kelly.
I'm embarrassed to admit I've not even heard of Ben
Hall. There you go. Yeah. People haven't. And they should have. And that's an example of a bit in the book where I genuinely hope it raises awareness. I would like to raise Ben Hall awareness.
Let's have a Ben Hall movie.
Correctly. Let's have a Ben Hall movie. Let's have a Ben Hall TV series. Let's get onto Netflix.
Oh, that would be a great TV.
It would be. I think that...
I don't even know anything about him except what you just told me.
I think
me.
A long time ago, there might have been a TV series that sunk without trace about him. But, like, certainly in the last 30 or 40 years, the Ned Kelly legend has grown.
Yeah.
Just like the Anzac legend has grown to the exclusion of other unbelievable stories from Australia's military history. You know, like the Rats of Tobruk neglected a little bit, and they were... That's an amazing story.
And I wonder why that is, that just...
We latch onto a theme.
Yeah.
You know, so Ben Hall is a big guy for me. I love the incompetent explorers. I love Hume and Hovell because they're famous and they were pioneers. They opened up land, they mapped and they discovered stuff, and they were of great benefit, but their entire journey was a fuck up from beginning to end. They went to the wrong place. They clearly couldn't even read a compass. They fought. They just bitched at each other from beginning to end about everything. They fought about the right way to cross a river. It's like one guy wants to, you know, build a raft. The other one wants to go the long way around. Never ended. And then Burke and Wells is another one. It's the most horrifically tragic story. Burke is another incompetent explorer who I love. He had no exploring skill whatsoever. He didn't know what to do. He brought the wrong stuff. He brought the wrong animals. He overburdened. The first bit of the Burke and Wells expedition is actually the story of Burke constantly, like, sacking men and sending things home because there was just too much stuff and they were moving so slowly. Burke and Wells set out from Melbourne in the middle of the day, and by midnight on the first day, like, four of their wagons had broken wheels, and that just sums up the expedition. But and the end of the Burke and Wells expedition is basically the story of they got back to their camp just a few hours after the men they'd been left there gave up and went home. And then they left a message saying, hey, we've been to this, we've come back and we're setting out to try and find some food and water. And they buried that message. And then when a rescue party got back to the camp to look for Burke and Wills, they didn't find the message. And so they thought, Burke and Wills never came back. We better just go home. And at every single point, it's like just nightmarish coincidence.
Oh, man.
Has killed these men. And the only reason it's funny is that it happened 150 years ago, so we don't care. Which is the benefit of history. You can make fun of a lot of really awful events because it was so long ago.
You've got that distance.
That distance, but it's also funny because it's just a demonstration of what I was saying before, that people in history were incompetent fools just like people now. And it's...
Just because they might
realize, be bronzed in statue. You know, at the end of the book, there's a chapter about more recent events. And of course, it's very, very easy to think of Malcolm Turnbull and Tony Abbott and Kevin Rudd as figures of fun because they're right in front of us and we're seeing that. But we don't see how ridiculous the explorers or the men of the First Fleet or the fathers of Federation Well, I like the chapter I did about Federation because I don't, you know, we don't know that much about the personal foibles of them, but I imagined them as just a pack of politicians, which they were. And we know what politicians are now, and there's no reason to think they are any different then. Yeah. And so I like that picture and just painting them as, you know, selfish, bigoted half-wits. Because, of course, if you got a bunch of our politicians together today to hammer out a plan for Federation, what would you expect? It's the same thing.
Yeah. I don't like to think about it.
No. Look, I mean, Australia has been described as a lucky country. We did get lucky in some respects. But so much of the advantages of the good parts of Australia literally are luck.
Yeah.
You know, people stumbling around and just happening. It happened to work out well.
Wading through like miles of bureaucracy to get somewhere good.
Yeah.
Well, look, I'm really excited for this book.
So am I.
We're all anticipating great things. And I just want to ask, are we allowed to ask what's up next? Like, do you have any other book plans?
Oh, so many. That's my problem. I have too many. I would like to... Well, I've written History of Australia. I'd like to do the History of the World next.
That would be amazing.
I would really like to do that. I would also like to do an educational primer on Australian politics.
Oh, wow.
And how it works. And more specifically, how it doesn't work.
Yeah.
So, you know, the world... I just want more things to make jokes about, and the world never stops supplying them. But I would also like to work. I've got some fiction that hopefully will see the light of day at some point, which hopefully will be just as funny as the non-fiction, even though, you know, you got to make up your own characters and then make fun of them. So it's an extra step from making fun of real people.
Oh, I look forward to all of those. That will be great. Well, Ben, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
It's been such a pleasure to meet you and hear about your book.
Thank you.
And podcast listeners, Era Australis by Ben Poggi is available to order now at Booktopia.
At Booktopia. Get into it.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.